Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Salyer Report Clifford Carnicom. He's the founder and head of the Carnicom Institute in Santa Fe, someone well deserving of your support, I might add, coming into the Christmas donation season. He's a research scientist, and he's spent nearly two decades now studying the phenomena of global spraying and what it is and what it means to us. He did a remarkable series of Salyer Reports in 2010. I strongly recommend to all new subscribers that they go back and revisit it. It's as powerful and relevant today as it was then. He also introduced his audience and us to Dr. Gwen Scott, who has also joined us on the Salyer Report in 2011 to talk about the impact of global spraying on our health and what we can do to take action about it. And I wanted Clifford to come back again to update on his work since the 2010 interviews. And again, I would encourage you to go back and read them. We're going to discuss them as we open today. So Clifford, welcome back to the Salyer Report. What a pleasure it is to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's great to be here again. I always respect your work equally, and I really appreciate the offer to be here today.
Well, in our second series of interviews in 2010, you went through the seven areas that might explain this phenomena, and I thought we would start today by revisiting those seven areas. I have them in front of me, and maybe I could just walk you through them.
I think that would be great, Catherine. Yeah, I think that would be a very good place to work.
Okay. So the first you defined is environmental modification and control, including weather modification.
Yes, and you know this issue that we're speaking of, you know, aerosol issue on a global scale, has been framed, especially. I do watch the history of issues and trends and patterns, and it's very interesting. There is a history. We're spanning now a period of, it's really getting close to 25 years, or two decades at least, that this issue actually has been in the forefront.
Right.
And if you look at that history, you'll find in the early years, for at least 5 years or so, this issue was framed entirely as a global warming issue. It was really quite interesting. It was something that was never going to be discussed publicly, but it was implied that somehow it was involved in global warming. And it also, that somehow this program is beneficial for us, but we're just not going to talk about it, and we're not really going to tell you or anyone why it's good for you or otherwise. And it ends up over time that I think from the beginning that framing of the issue was completely inadequate and misrepresented and underrepresented, but it was very effective in terms of planting a framework of perception by the public that this is primarily what the issue is about. My categorization of that topic of environmental modification and control is acknowledgement of that that factor in the equation. But also, as we go through the rest of the list, understand that it's only one factor. And in addition, even environmental modification and control, weather is actually just a subset of that. So I do believe that it's intentional that perception was foisted upon the public, and really was very well planted and made its mark and still is today. But that topic, environmental modification and control, was meant to state that the means, the mechanisms to affect the environment in a much broader sense, just beyond that of the weather, are in place.
Right. Well, I know, just as a financial matter, I've seen far more patterns of weather warfare, what I call weather warfare. So I'm convinced that just from watching the financial patterns that weather modification is upon us and is happening.
Right. You know, and incidentally, along the way, I do want to thank you for making your presentations from last year available. I did watch your presentation on the financial aspect from the 2014 conference. It must have been the space conference. And your presentation was, you know, that's the first time that I have heard someone call attention to this issue of the missing $4 trillion in such depth and importance that, you know, I remember that. That article, when it came out, made an impression upon me that day, and I never heard hardly another word about it. So I was really glad to see your presentation that acknowledged the depth and extent of what we're talking about. And what you are speaking about there completely underlies everything that we are speaking of, because money is how things happen. And so I just wanted to appreciate for you making that available, and to be aware that that's very much on my mind, what you were speaking in terms of the scale and extent of these operations.
Well, it proves that they have the financing in place to do these kinds of things.
Yes, I mean, basically unaccounted for. The scale is just unmanageable to me. Okay, you're talking about major portions of the entire budget of the entire nation, just completely unaccounted for, with no discussion, with nothing on it.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
It's pretty remarkable. The second one we talked about was the biological operations, and literally what's in the spring changing the biology, frankly, of everything.
Yes, and this is also, it's an example of a topic that was emerging also fairly early in the game. If you look at the research, my work started at the close of 1999. By mid-2000 or so, within that first year, there was evidence emerging of some biological aspects to this that were not at all being talked about. And actually, they were not accepted or welcomed. In fact, we're still going through that transition 20 years later, because that introduces another whole dimension of that beyond physical matter, beyond, you know, things and material matter being put in the sky as something has life to it. Then that changes the dimensions. And the work did show that very early on. And I have to do whatever the evidence presents, I have to make that available. And I did. There were very, very science fiction, uncomfortable periods of presentation of information that had no context at the time. That work has its place. It has continued, and it remains a very deep and central theme of the issue. And it must be brought, I think, to equal prominence, for example, with anyone thinking of the environmental or weather side alone.
Right. Well, I want to come back to that after we go through the seven things, because, you know, they tend to connect to each other, but
they do.
It's one I've spent a lot more time thinking about, and I wanted to get your take on it. But let's move on to the third. The third is the electromagnetic aspects and the change to the atmosphere as a result.
Yes, this is another example of a dimension that would go just beyond the notion of I'm fussing with the weather. And that is, if there is a change in the physical properties, in this case particularly of the atmosphere that we're speaking of, and more specifically an electromagnetic alteration of that environment, then that also completely changes the picture in terms of what can be done, and how it can be done, and what and who it affects, and how large of a scale of an operation is all of these things are also considerations that must be on the table if you demonstrate that there is an alteration in the electromagnetic properties of the atmosphere. And we have forces in our world that we do not directly see or feel, and yet they are really, when you think about it from a physical standpoint, they're the fundamental forces of the universe. When you think of things as gravity and electromagnetics, that's what holds everything together, then it would be folly to ignore that in the discussion.
Right. Okay, the fourth is the likely conduct of military operations.
Well, this one is something that is a way of our world, and that is Unfortunately, these generations of time in history are dominated by technology that unfortunately is not generally used for the betterment of mankind. I think many of us can understand the need for a defense aspect of a country. I mean, I grew up in a military family. My father was in the Navy. I worked for the Department of Defense for 15 years. Reality serves to let us know that such defense systems need to be in place. But when we become so unbalanced as really a global population as to sink most of our money, most of our resources, most of our energy into systems that have a primary objective of obliteration or destruction, it is a serious imbalance in what I'd call the nobler pursuits of mankind.
Right, and it's, I mean, if you look at the money, it's extraordinary. It's a, you know, we now, one of the most expensive parts of military operations is the creation of false enemies.
Yes,
exactly. To keep the military operations going, yeah.
Yeah, a whole fabricated world, a whole fabricated environment. And you know, the point here is that these physical alterations that we're speaking of, where you alter the environment, then you you create an environment where systems can exploit those changes, and those systems are often of a military nature.
Right. Then the fifth is a little bit more conceptual, and that is the geophysical modification. In other words, we're talking about planetary, you know, modification. We're talking about modification on a planetary scale.
It is, and this would be, you know, again, to confine ourselves to a weather notion is just, I think it's misguided. I think it's myopic to think of things in terms of, you know, clouds, rain, sky, and this type of thing. And there was a period of time for probably 2 or 3 years where I was able to delve into a broader scale geophysical impact. I worked in geophysical sciences in my life. I worked in modeling the gravity field. So I have a mental picture of these force fields that I'm speaking of. That surround us on a global level and even a cosmic level. And I was able to start thinking about how some of these areas might be affected, and that is this issue. And for an example, one example would be like the magnetic field. And like you say, these fields all cross over with one another. But one example would be that if you read Bernard Eastman's patent, on the what's called the Hart patent, but it certainly has all the tenets in place to justify the existence of that facility being a claimed research facility for ionospheric research. But if you read that patent, you'll find this very interesting reference to the development of a weapon system that involves the magnetic field of the Earth, and what the weapon system, what it actually does is accumulate enough energy on a geophysical level that lifts up the magnetic field of the Earth, I mean the actual field, lifts up that field and then slams it down back on the Earth. And it's called a heave weapon, H-E-A-V-E. It's called a heave weapon within that document. And it's characterized as having, you know, all of the advantages of a nuclear bomb without actually having a bomb. Okay, this is
right.
An example of a geophysical influence at a Earth scale, global scale, that is far beyond just the notion of the weather. And during that work, I started digging into the data on the magnetic field, of which there isn't a, your data points are few. They go back to the 1800s, and you pick up one a decade at that time in terms of the global database that I had access to. By the way, that database was later removed when I went back. But looking at that database, it's absolutely fascinating to see a major anomaly that took place on this planet in the 1940s during the era of, you know, the atomic warfare activity and testing. It's a fascinating a notion to look at.
One of the things I just, 2 weeks ago, I was at a conference in Bastrop, Texas on the secret space program, and there was a lot of discussion on the CERN, on the Hadron Collider, and in fact, Joseph Farrell and I discussed it a lot this week in the Solaria Report, and whether or not, you know, it is the official story or whether we're talking about something that can impact the magnetic field of the planet. And
and how got into the
same questions.
Yeah, exactly. How would we know? I mean, it's fascinating. I'm not a high particle physicist, but there's an analogy there to me that humans have a way of poking their fingers into things that they don't necessarily understand the full ramifications of, and they act as though they do, and then they present an authoritative claim that they do when they do not have such jurisdiction, they do not have such knowledge, because they simply do not have the depth of knowledge to understand those ramifications, however it may be claimed. History bears that out, whether it's nuclear power testing or space systems that are underway. That system is one such topic that I think is subject to debate about our level of knowledge and how it might impact the world or planet in ways that we do not know. And what we do know is that the general population is certainly not a part of that discussion, that we have a separation and isolation of those, either authority figures or scientific communities where it's constrained, confined, or classified essentially such that the public never even knows what is happening.
Right. And part of the problem with this kind of suppression of information is you don't get a full vetting of the issues. Surveillance. The sixth thing we talked about was the development of a surveillance system. Maybe if you could touch on that.
Sure, Catherine. The surveillance issue, there's a point when it's sort of like the aha moment where you just realize that, well, this makes sense. And the way that I came across it was I was doing some research, and I think it's called the Federation of American Scientists. I may be off a little bit on that name, but I know it's close.
And no, it's Federation of American Scientists. Great group.
Oh, yes. Okay. And I found a paper by them, and it's interesting. It's like this group was trying to make amends in a way in their paper for having been involved in the nuclear testing and basically saying, this probably wasn't so good what we were doing. This is my own paraphrasing. It's not what they said.
Right.
It's sort of like they were trying to make amends, and then they were saying, postulating, well, what is it that we think we would sort of be involved in the future? What do we think we should work on now, since we think maybe the nuclear thing was not so hot to be doing? And they brought up this topic of LIDAR. It was fascinating to me because this is obviously a think tank at the highest level in terms of what we think is the most important thing to be working on. And here this group was stating, they're basically putting forth a proposition that what we think we should be working on is LIDAR. And so I look up at LIDAR, it's LIDAR, and conceptually understand what it is, and it fascinates me to know in terms of the implications of that. And that's how this topic came about, because many of us know of radar, and radar is a system where you bounce a radio wave off of something and you can detect its existence or not, whether it's a ship or a plane or whatever. LIDAR is the same idea, except it uses light waves instead of radio waves. And the fascinating part of this is that the main difference for LIDAR would be the size of the particles that you're detecting. Instead of detecting a boat or a ship or a plane, LIDAR is directed towards microscopic, micron-sized, submicron-sized particles. And so when you start thinking about the development of a system that essentially could monitor and track the location and distribution and movement of material on a micro or nano scale, the possibilities are completely endless in terms of what that means, but one of them that expressed was certainly that this has real prospects for development of surveillance systems at essentially a microscopic level. You breathe particulates, right?
Right.
The particulates in our body. How could I eliminate the prospect of developing a system that would allow me to track information down to the microscopic level at any location that I chose to with the proper sensitivity of detection? And
oh, you know, I don't know if I told you this in the last, I don't know if I told you this, Cliff, in the last interview, but in the, I guess it was about 2000, 2001, there was a guy who used to be very senior in covert operations at the agency and the CIA, and he'd left. I suspect he was still doing projects for them, but he kind of showed up in my life very suspiciously and tried to persuade me of a whole bunch of different things, one of which was that by breathing in these, you know, the materials that were in the spraying, they were basically creating a global ID system because we were all, the particles would find each other in our body and it would create the equivalent of an organic bar chip, you know, mm-hmm. You know, like when you check out of the, yeah. You know, and one of the things I always wondered is whether all the different scanners at the airports that you have to go through was a mm-hmm. feedback loop helping them fine-tune the system. Well,
I have to say, how can I eliminate that, you know, from consideration?
Right.
How can I?
Right.
How can I? Because what is being said there is exactly the picture that I have. And in fact, you know, the way the material interacts with everything will be unique, and therefore it's quite sensible to me that unique signatures could be presented at essentially the cellular level or lower. It's quite conceivable to me. That's where that's where that issue came from in the research.
Right. I think what these guys literally want is the ultimate database of everything, you know, that can be managed as a dynamic system in a simulation.
Well, in fact, that was even openly claimed, right? The whole, whatever was no total information, what was ever that name was?
Yeah, total information awareness or something.
Remember that? TIA or whatever, and then, oh, no, okay, it must be a mistake. We're not really going to do that. Well, that's the drive for everything. The drive for everything is based upon complete and total collection of all information with the ability to respond instantaneously. That is our world.
And one of my favorite artistic renditions, and I've had it on the Soleil Report and encourage people to watch it. In 2006, the French did a version of Stravinsky's Nightingale, and it's remarkable if you haven't seen it. It's part animation, part opera, and in it they have, you know, little birds flying around with barcode creators that are putting barcodes on everything. and it's a you know, the digitization of everything, and it's really hysterical to watch. And I thought, you know, we know, the artists know, they know what's going on.
If you think something is science fiction, you know, a good part of it is well implanted in a way that we don't even know.
Right. Okay, the seventh was the detection of energy sources. So this is a kind of relates to the surveillance, but it's pretty interesting. So let me just read exactly as we had it. The detection of energy sources and energy disturbances within the atmosphere, and that would relate to consideration of propulsion systems and unusual or exotic propulsion systems and energy systems.
Yes. Again, these last three, all of us three of these were based on a conceptual understanding rather than, let's say, the collection of information on a global scale. I simply don't have access to that.
Right.
I have the ability to think. And I can visualize and I can see. And if I have a gas, in this case the atmosphere, if I have an atmosphere around me that has been altered electromagnetically, and there are now charged particles in that, the analogy would be that of the ionosphere. If you do some research on the ionosphere and what happens up there, it completely changed everything in the history of mankind with respect to communications with radio. That's how radio overseas, first long distance communication across the globe is based upon the ionosphere. So if you just imagine that environment and just bring it down to ground level, not necessarily the same concentration by any means, but nevertheless the notion of having electrical charged particles within this atmosphere, then one of your next levels of consideration is not the state of something, you know, let's call it the number and the magnitude, but any scientist, mathematician, particularly, they're very interested in change. They like to detect changes in things. This is the basis of certainly much of the mathematics of our world. It starts by looking at change because it's easier to get a handle on, is what it amounts to. You can measure change easier than you can measure the magnitude of something. And so if you start thinking about, well, what if you could detect a change? So this might mean at a localized place, within that environment. What if you could detect changes of ionic state or electrical charge, state or concentration within a particular area? What would that mean? And what it means or ties in with our system, there are systems, advanced systems of propulsion that use ionic streams. If you look at our space program, this is one of the main methods of propulsion that is in vogue, either develop or wish to have, and these are ionic propulsion systems. Well, wouldn't it make sense that if you had the ability to, that you would want to detect changes in the atmosphere that might detect the existence of such systems? If you look at advanced navigation and our propulsion systems, wouldn't you want the ability? And I would say yes, that you do. And I'll tell you, there's very
right. So this deals with the black budget technology and the UFOs and, you know, the things flying around in our skies, which clearly are not flying on fossil fuels.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And this is number 7, and this list, I have to say, I haven't changed it one bit in five years now. I don't think I've changed it one bit.
Well, I have a couple of questions and points on these 7 that I want to go into, and then we'll dive into our second list. The first is, I really got a lot of opposition when I started to do in 2010 a series on the global spraying. And it started, I did 3. One was where I did an overview myself, and then the first interview with you, and then this big interview where we had the 7 issues. And when I announced the first, I had a couple of subscribers come in to me and say, look, you're going to totally destroy your credibility to talk about this. It's unacceptable. You know, this is really going to harm you. You're going to lose a lot of subscribers. You can't talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed because I'd been driving. I started a process in 1998 where I'd been driving all over the country. And, you know, between, say, 98 and 2010, when we did these series, I had driven more than 500,000 miles around the United States and traveled around the world. And there was global spraying going on everywhere. And if you watched it and watched the patterns, you know, somebody was spraying. I mean, it was obvious. You know, people used to say, I had no evidence. I said, well, how about my own affidavit? I'm prepared to testify in court. You know, I can. Yeah. And it was always strange, Clifford, because in any group of people, there were some people who would openly talk about the spraying because they could see it. And then, you know, you had the majority of people who insisted it didn't exist when it was happening right over your head as you were speaking in crisscross patterns that weren't possibly, you know, contrails. And you know, you had this bizarre situation where it wasn't allowed in the official reality. And it was very interesting because there was one subscriber who was adamant that I couldn't do this. And we did the series of 3, and they came back to me and said, you know, I really want to apologize because, you know, I need to know this. I need to deal with this. This is really important. And I don't. It was one of my first introductions to this bizarre bifurcation between reality and official reality that seems in the last 20 years to have gotten so Orwellian is the only way I can describe it. But maybe if you could say a few words about it. Seems to me it's getting better. People are finally beginning to acknowledge, yes, there is a global spraying program.
It is getting better. I think it's on one side you can say, you know, it's rewarding, fulfilling that change is taking place. I can also express my deep frustration and disappointment that it's taken the human race, you know, 2 decades to understand that something is real when it's every single breath that you take in your life and affecting your
right.
health and welfare and the entire planet in a way that, you know, have very important consequences, no matter what you think it is. I can go either way, and I can see the glass both sides, but I do my work on the glass being, you know, half full and keep on. But yes, it is most amazing, and this made its mark from the very beginning, this split, this polarization, that there's something real here, or you're imagining something and you're crazy. And all the marks of conditioning, mental conditioning on a grand scale in a way that, you know, we can't define, and yet it's almost has the marks of a program that's in place to affect the general awareness level and critical thinking abilities of
right.
human beings on a grand level. You know, it has some analogies to television. It has analogies to propaganda. The ability to manipulate the mass psychology of the population to convince them. It has to do with Oklahoma bombing. It has to do with 9/11. It has
right.
to do with the mass persuasion of the global population that an issue is, it's presented as it's presented to you on TV, and this is all that you need to know. And
right.
this issue was striking in that way because it went right to the heart of relationships. I saw many, many relationships dissolved because of a fundamental ability and willingness to confront an issue and simply put it on the table versus putting up blinders and just say, I don't want to talk about this, or to
right.
tell someone that you're not supposed to talk about this, rather than flush it out on the table for all that needs to be done. And it, from the very beginning, it was that way. And it really has raised questions in my mind about how psychology on a global scale can be influenced in a way that people don't even know that it's happening. And
right.
I don't know what causes the difference in terms of what is it that allows, you know, some people to think critically, independently, and be willing to face something, whether it's uncomfortable or not. I mean, maybe we all have our threshold somewhere. I don't know. You know, you can run into those studies in terms of, you know, torture analysis and, you know, extreme cases that none of us would ever want to go to. And maybe everyone has their limit. But we've seen a case where literally the physical alteration of our world in a way that can be directly evidenced, as you demonstrated, the most simplistic way possible, and that is driving across this country and our planet and having that issue denied in supposedly a rational setting.
Right. It's phenomenal to watch. One of the things I've talked about and worked a lot with some of the people who joined me on the Salier Report, John Rappaport being one of them, is this issue of mind control, both individual and sort of mass mind control. And one of the questions I've thought a lot more about the global spraying is whether or not some of the materials, including biological materials in the spraying, are designed to create within the biological entity, including humans, to make it easier through the cell towers and smartphones to manipulate or resonate. You know, my theory is we've got an effort to get humans to resonate with their smartphones instead of with other living things and other living intelligence. So rather than a natural resonance with the divine intelligence is the way I would say it, you know, you're trying to get everybody and everything to resonate into the smartphones through the cell towers. And I'm wondering if any of those materials enhance the capacity of the whatever's coming, whatever entrainment's coming through the different media to, you know, to reach deeper and impact on a biological level.
Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that we have these questions, you know, if you and I are thinking of this, then there's people that work on things. You know, we have the freedom to think about things, right, and try to figure things out on the back door. But if we think of such things, let's just say I know of worlds, however limited my exposure has been, I know of worlds where work takes place. And this means if I have the idea, well, let's just say if I was running my own university, if I have an idea, I'll put somebody on that idea, I'll put them to work. And I won't just be thinking about it. And these topics, maybe some people consider them to be outside reality, but in my world, in your world, I suspect, they're very much in our reality, and they should be to the forefront, and they're not.
Both you and I have worked in the federal government, so we know, you know, the kinds of things that can go on.
I want to do research on my own. I can't. I have hundreds of ideas. Right? Imagine if you have your you're missing $4 trillion. Okay.
My estimate is now $40 trillion with the bailouts.
All right, well, there we go. You can help me by a factor of 10, and it's not a surprise to us, I suppose. I mean, but just imagine what you're doing with that funding, right? What's your question there, right? Is whether or not we're altering fundamental electromagnetic interactions in biology. And you don't think that would be a hot topic of research in all seven areas, basically, that we just talked about? And who is it that has access to managing systems over those seven areas? You know?
Well, needless to say, the guy who does will win all the elections.
Yeah.
Right. So there's one other point I want to bring up, and probably because I can get a little comfort on it because I, you know, this is, can consider this kind of a whine. I have a standard operating procedure. If you want to talk to me about climate change and you're not prepared to address how global spraying fits in, then you're deleted. You're hung up on. I won't even talk to you. It's like, don't even.
You know, we have to choose at some point. Same thing. I'm 62 now, right? I was 45 or whenever when this stuff started. We have to make choices about what we do with our time. And this is our most valuable commodity in this world. We learn slowly over time. Is that of time?
Right.
So we have to make choices about where we put our energy and where we put our time. And all I could say is I understand your decision.
Well, how do we have a world of just a world of people who are talking about this who refuse to include or address global spraying? How can it really be that ridiculous?
Well, it's unfortunately be as it is because all the systems to make that happen are in place, okay?
Yep.
Everything that is needed to make that happen is in place. Certainly the media, right? You can count off the influences. Think about the influence that the media has on what people do. My wife writes in her journal, and she was at the laundromat the other day, and people that came in a laundromat were asking her, what are you doing? In other words, for somebody to write, okay, it's like literature and the spoken word. to think of that as something that has real depth and meaning in our lives is going by the wayside. If it's not on your smartphone, or I don't really like that term, smartphone myself. Dumb phone is more horrific. if it's not tuned into a 2-second soundbite that's in a video flashing MTV format, then most of us are in the minority. And
right.
So all the systems that create a world of instant gratification, okay, media blitz, lack of critical thinking, information overload, lack of ability to distinguish between reality and script. If all of these systems are in place, which they are, then this is why we have. And then you get into health issues, right, and education or lack thereof. And when you put and nutrition, and when you put these things together, this is the reason that we're in this state. And it's not going to change until you essentially have a revolution that completely scraps these destructive forces and creates and implants something of the creative nature of humankind.
Yeah, you really need a spiritual and cultural revolution of consciousness. Yeah. Okay. So we have to talk about Dr. Gwen Scott, who you introduced me to, and who did a Solaria report, which was one of the most magical. I think I've told you the story of what she. I did a pre-interview with her, and the focus was what does the ingredients of Global Spraying do to your body, and what do you do about it? And it was so dark that. I laid down and prayed for 2 hours. I have a Quantron resonance system. I did a whole bunch of sessions, and I called her back and I said, look, we're not going to discuss what it does to you, you know, what's in it and what it does to you. We're just going to discuss the 10 action steps of what you can do to mitigate the impact on your health. And I would encourage everybody listening to go read that transcript or listen to that interview, because it's remarkable and very, still very timely. And she said, she listened to me and she said, well, that's a great idea. And, you know, I love your 10 items, but you forgot the most important one. And I said, really, what's that? And she said, grace. She said, if you look at what's going on, we should be dead, but we're not. So something else is happening.
Yeah.
And it shifted my whole, you know, my life. Sometimes I think of my life as before and after Dr. Gwen Scott. So I just wanted take a moment and thank you for that and see if you wanted to add anything, because I know she passed recently, and I put up a little commentary to celebrate her life, but I just think she was such a remarkable human being, and your interviews with her are fantastic. If anybody hasn't, check them out on the internet. You can just do a search and pick them up.
Yes, you know, I was called upon, I guess, a couple of months ago to realize that there are several people now. You know, the list is accumulating. Like I say, I'm 62. It's just not the same. And there's actually a group of people now that are behind us that have passed, that I've been associated with over the years. And Gwen is certainly in the ranks of that list. And I put up a page to that effect to at least give some kind of respect.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. It's beautiful.
To what these people have done. And, you know, yeah. we are such a soundbite society that we don't even realize what's taken place before us and the sacrifices that have been made in many ways. And there is now, with 20 years behind us, there is a host of people. That
real heroes, real heroes.
They really are. And
real heroes.
And I do not want us to forget these people. And Gwen is such a person. You know, Gwen came from the ranks of CNN. She's right in the heart of what we're talking about. She came from a world when she told me her stories, and I could imagine. I actually even have a memory, I think, of seeing her as a younger kid on the air. I never did watch TV that much, but she was a CNN reporter. And she came from the era, it's expressed beautifully in the documentary that I did where she's on tape, of what the true job of a journalist is, okay, that it was a story and it was a truth. And the sacrifices were tremendous in the history of the profession of journalism. And she came from that era, and she has watched that transition take place to what I would call a propaganda forum that's in place now. And it was, it was still in her blood, and it was still in her heart to get to that story. And she worked hard, but she, regardless of whether or not she had assistance or cooperation from those, her peers, let's say, in her profession, which ultimately she did not at the highest level, basically. I'll give initials TT as one example of a person fighting with that network that she would certainly have direct connection with. And she did not receive that support from anyone, but she did what she knew she had to do. And her record is clear, and she does deserve our respect.
Yeah, it's amazing when people just decide, I'm just going to stick with the truth and see where it goes. And whatever it does, it always leads, the pathway almost always leads you outside of, certainly outside of the media corporations, that's for sure. Let's talk about your recent collaboration with the National Health Freedom Congress, because I think that is very important. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's an interesting sort of transition that has started to take place over the last couple of years. And primarily, I need to give credit to some other people that recognize the importance of what we're speaking of. And this organization called National Health Freedom Coalition, which is run by Diane Miller, an attorney, has impressed me from the beginning. And in the general form, it's a body of organizations, companies, nonprofits, attorneys. It's a group of people across the nation that understand the rights and the needs of human beings to make their own decisions regarding their own health choices in life, and to not have that freedom unduly legislated or restricted by organized groups that have certain lobbying powers. And so, if you want to go and drink milk from your cow, that you have the freedom to do that. That if you do not wish to have somebody inject something into your body without your permission, that you have these rights. So the vaccine issue is obviously very high on their list. And what happened a couple of years ago was Diane invited me to come out to that annual meeting in Minnesota. And there's actually about three people in an organization that they are aware of the importance and the depth of the issues that we're speaking of today. And essentially, they are ahead of their times, too, I think, because they invited me there, really assuming their own risk level. That the truth is, the organization and the entities there were really not familiar with this issue, I have to say, when I came there. I was like a new kid on the block, and I'm not very good at sound bites, so I don't do real well if somebody gives me 30 seconds to talk. But it was an open door with people that understood the importance of the issue to say, hey, I think we need to bring this into the discussion here, because this issue is big enough that it relates to everything that we're talking about in this Congress and in this room. The Congress is actually an annual meeting where people submit certain resolutions that they think are important. I would call it model legislation. These are resolutions that hopefully will eventually take some effect in the legislative sense, and so that's the purpose of this Congress. And so I was invited back for this second year, and I have to say, it does seem like a turning point in terms of recognition within the group on a broader scale, that there is a very deep connection between the nature of the type of work I'm involved in and the very issues, that these things are all one and the same when we talk about certainly lack of informed consent is at the heart of all of these issues that we're speaking of, and the freedom and right to choose our course in life with respect to our health and welfare. There's no separation that can be made in this. And
right.
So it was a very, very productive and helpful meeting this year, and I'm continuing to collaborate with some members of the group, and in fact, that's one of the main directions at the Institute that is going that I want to talk about.
Now, for our subscribers, can I post a link to the resolution that they issued on the geoengineering?
It's so recent that I'm not sure they even have it on their website yet. I did give you an advanced copy of it by mail.
Okay.
So you have it, and then what we'll do is just make that available. But the thing to do also is we want to keep an eye on the website. And it will be the National Health Freedom Congress, and it may be up there now. Literally, it's this happened.
Okay, so I'll check and try and link to their website.
Yeah,
now
yeah,
I have a couple of.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of prejudices in this area, so I want to.
I understand.
Just put them forth.
And I may too. I
may too. Right.
Go ahead.
If you look at recent studies and you take women my age who do not have a high school education, since 1990, their life expectancy has dropped 5 years. And we're seeing all sorts of reports. And certainly from what I can see anecdotally where I live and communities that I'm very familiar with, it looks to me like you're seeing two things. One is the immune systems declining and toxicity levels rising. You know, just driving around America, the toxicity levels from just watching people are very high. And I just came from Europe, and they're so much higher here than in Europe from anything I can see. I associate it very much with the spraying. And part of it is, you know, that there was a real effort to bring financial and fiscal accountability to the budget coming into 95. And then the leadership pretty much gave up. And the reality is the other way you can bring accountability is simply by lowering the life expectancy. And I, you know, this is partly in my mind because aluminum and heavy metals is part of the spraying. And, you know, and I think the spraying is very much contributing to a rise in toxicity levels and a lowering of life expectancy, certainly in the United States. I'm not as familiar with other areas. And, you know, so that is really my prejudice. And at this point, I think it's perfectly plausible that there is an intention to lower life expectancy through the spraying. Not to say that that would be the only goal, but, you know, whenever something is this expensive, it's always multivariate in my experience. But I think, you know, the rise of aluminum is a real concern, especially when the possibility that it contributes to Alzheimer's. And I think people need to know that is, in fact, one of the ingredients, and it is rising aluminum levels in the environment.
You know, we have to deal with reality. By the way, my prejudice is of a different nature, so maybe I'll try to. if I get to it, it's more on the legislative side. But in terms of what you're saying, my comment is, how can we wish to avoid reality? How can we choose to avoid reality? And the issue of life expectancy, you know, let's just say I don't think we have the real scoop on it, is what it amounts to.
Right.
Because if
right.
you look at the patterns, you know, you can shape data any way that you want. But there is a trend that is well in place now. And that is, and it was phrased in an interesting way by a doctor I heard a couple of years ago. And I think it was right on the mark. Because people will come out and they'll claim that, you know, life expectancy is increasing, right? And that our health system is improving. And this guy countered that interviewer and said, well, that's not actually the case. What is happening is that life expectancy is increasing for those of, let's call it, privileged means, okay? Those
mm-hmm.
that have the means, their life expectancy is increasing. But in the sense of the masses and those that do not have access to resources, and privilege, their life expectancy is decreasing. And I believe that the masses account for the majority of this population, and that if we were to get the true data on life expectancy, everything to me says it's going down and has been going down for some time. And I think that it was predictable that it was going to go down from the very beginning when you can see this. And there is data. I've seen data that shows that it's there. It's just that I don't see anything that is consistent in terms of how that is presented. I see numbers that show it less, and I see numbers that show it more. Reality to me says that the life expectancy is absolutely decreasing. And there's really
if you look at what I'm watching, when I first moved to the county that I live in Tennessee, you know, I started to discuss with people that it looked like life expectancy was dropping. You know, and what was their experience? How did it, you know, so all this is very anecdotal, but what I could see was that people's immune systems were falling and their toxicity levels were rising. And so everybody was dying of their own particular thing. So it didn't look like one thing, you know, it all looked very natural. But in fact, it wasn't natural at all because, in fact, you know, if you looked at it in terms of their underlying health, it was absolutely, you know, they were all falling prey to the same general deterioration of immune system and rise in toxicity.
Absolutely. You know, somewhere on my site many, many years ago, but I remember I actually started to look into the mortuary statistics and predictions, actuarial data. On what was projected, and that was a long time ago, but there was an interesting paper I put up there that showed what I would call an unusual change in the trend of mortality. And of course, you know, you have an aging population, people will always have their counter arguments, and they're to be considered fairly in the discussion. You know, you have an aging population, but what we're talking about, if we can ever get to the real source of the data, is the change in life expectancy, right? Not the numbers of people that are dying, but the change in life expectancy and the quality. Is it that much of a stretch to say that if the quality of your environment deteriorates, that more people will die younger? I don't think it's a stretch at all. I think it's expected.
I will say this. I went through a very serious heavy metals detox in 2006 and 2007, and the difference in my mental energy and acuity and physical energy, you know, before and after was so remarkable. You know, I didn't believe you could get that kind of remarkable change, but it really told me, you know, these chemicals can have a very, and the particularly the heavy metals can really... It's quite remarkable what they can do to a human being. So, let's turn to current general research activities of the Institute. I'm almost afraid to ask, what are you up to these days, Clifford?
Well, every day is a day of discovering my life, I suppose, would be one way of saying it. You know, my lifestyle is changing now. I'm retired, I suppose, if you want to say it that way, but I'm busier than ever, of course, and even more so. But my schedule is more of my own calling now, and we live a more mobile lifestyle. As a matter of fact, we're heading out tomorrow for a fairly extensive visit to the Southwest. Oh, by the way, I'm actually in northern Idaho now. It's about 2 years ago, and we're actually headed back down to Santa Fe.
I didn't realize you'd moved. Okay.
Yeah, about 3 years ago, it's up north. I used to live up in Montana country or so in the past a couple of times. So we're up here now, but we're heading down south, actually starting tomorrow.
Are you near Moscow?
No, I'm near Coeur d'Alene, a very northern.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's so beautiful.
I don't even know a lot of the state yet because there are significant mountains that are a barrier, geographic barrier for me to get south. So I'm up in the very northern portion of it, outside of Coeur d'Alene away. So my schedule and lifestyle are changing, and the vision of where the work needs to go is also changing over time. You know, if you look at the history, I was an independent researcher and still am. That role is certainly still there. But in many ways, it was like the lone wolf of just saying, hey, this is what I see, folks. And whether, again, we like it or not, I would put out the information that's there. There's a limit to how far that can go in terms of impact by a single person, and that's partly why the nonprofit was created. So long-term trends will be centered more towards trying to create a network with those of similar motive and desire to improve the world. And so that's the direction I'll go more. But basically, when I am here at the lab, I hit it as hard as I can. I work often 10 to 12, 16 hours a day and do as much as I can in the lab and get as much data as I can. And then we go camping. Okay. So, and I take all my data with me. Maybe that's the part where I don't have a complete mental break, because I take all my data with me. I'm pretty good at separating myself and enjoying other. There's other parts of life. My life isn't one-track mind. In fact, the older I get, the more interesting life has become to me. But I take my work with me, and that's what will happen when I go on this trip. So I'm always in it, I suppose, now. But I do have, hopefully, a sense of balance in my life that I also fortunately, I'm not working in any kind of job situation, and my schedule is more flexible. So this has happened for the last, we had our interview in 2010, I think, or 2013, a year, do you remember, 2010?
2010. Yeah, 2010.
Yeah, 2010. So we have 5 years, and I was actually just starting to look at the work that's gone on since then. And our summary that we had, a set of 7 items, was very, very good in terms of its consolidation, and as I say, hasn't changed. But what we see without any question in the work, as I look at these papers, there's been, it looks like, a couple dozen more papers that have been written since that time. Overall, I haven't actually counted them, but it appears there's about 300 plus papers that have been written over the 17 years. We have a couple dozen of them, and if we look at the general trend of them, they have, without any doubt, been focused on the biological aspects of these operations, which would be 1 out of 7. But the reason that this happened was, I think, because of a necessary evolution. In other words, these issues are not separate, as we said. These 7 things, they just cross over right and left all the time.
Right.
But if you look,
absolutely,
at that work for a decade or so, it was primarily of an environmental nature in general. The biological side was always there. But there was a lot of what is classically thought of as geoengineering was more the subject of the work. And then after our interview, we can see in the work that it's shifted towards the biological side. And this had to do because of the recognition and understanding of the role of our health in the picture. In other words, I know how I am when I'm sick, and I'm terrible. I'm a basket case if I'm sick. Everything changes in my life.
Right.
I can't think the way I need to. I can't have fun the way I need to. I can't explore the way I need to and want to. Everything changes. And when I mentioned about priorities in our life, I think many of us, as we gain the stature of wisdom and awareness in our life, realize that, your things are not going to carry forward and mean too much with you. But your time in your life, the actual time, the time that you spend, what you do, and your health, both of these things have the greatest of meaning in our lives as we mature. And I realize as we're going along that the environmental, it's all there. That work, the work is there. You can look at that work and you can decide whether or not you think something is real or not. But the pattern is that the health of us as a population, in a very general sense, is deteriorating. It's more bringing to the forefront of what you're talking about life expectancy in a more direct way. We cannot base our actions in life on reading a study from somebody telling us whether something is true or not. We have to act on our instincts, our gut, our awareness, our education, our own critical thinking. We have to forge our own paths ahead. At least I do.
Right.
And in this case, I don't need somebody to convince me through a study that health is deteriorating. And I know how I am when I'm sick, and it's like, if you don't have your health, you don't have anything as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Right.
And so the work shifted towards the deeper investigations of emerging health situations that appeared, again, I'm always too diplomatic in my language, but they appear to be in direct correspondence and have a relationship to the physical changes in the environment that were taking place.
Now, right, and this included Morgellons disease.
Exactly. This centered on the, quote, Morgellons condition. The name itself is problematic. This is a name, you know, hopefully over time this works itself out, but it has its impact for years. The word chemtrails had its impact, a negative impact as far as I was concerned. I know the word is used, and that's, people will do as they please, and that's fine. I just don't use the term because that term, if you look at it historically and you look at how things are treated in the media, if you do not work with language that has a conventional and formal understanding and acceptance and can be marginalized, it will. Okay, it's part of the way things work. Language is important. And
right.
the quote geoengineering issue was framed in a certain way that made it easier to marginalize the issue. And that's the last thing we needed. And the Morgellons issue is something that was treated the same way. And this is why it certainly caught my
Can you describe what it is? Because not everybody listening will know what Morgellons is.
Absolutely. And thank you for forcing me around to the specifics at some point, because it might be hard to get here. But there is a health condition that emerged, and I would suppose it dates, I forget when my first paper was, might have been around 2003, something like that. I'd have to find that date. But there was a health condition that emerged where people were reporting unusual symptoms, particularly related to lesions or sores on the skin. Two main characteristics, I would say, visibly. One would be sores on the skin that would not heal properly, you know, open type sores. And another would be the appearance of a filament structure coming out of the skin. So you had two physical, very unusual filament that it simply wasn't hair. I know you can make your arguments about what you think something is, but the fact is it wasn't hair. And so you had two physical things. They were tangible. They were able to be seen. And in terms of filament samples, they're able to be produced and presented. And you had this disconnect take place in that you had people reporting of this condition, going to their doctor and giving their reports, going to the media and having the reports come out from the media. And without almost exception, with very, very few exceptions, the people that would go and seek medical assistance and help, they were told they were crazy.
Yeah, there were really two problems. One was the Morgellons, and the second was the time and money you wasted trying to deal with a traditional medical establishment on Morgellons. And you know, the people who did the best were the ones who got through the time and money waste with the traditional as fast as possible and gone on to real solutions.
This is true. This is absolutely true. The CDC was involved in this, and they made a mockery of the issue. So what caught my interest was how these people were marginalized and dismissed, even in the face of direct physical evidence. And also, again, what appeared to be almost like a script that was written, that they were destined to be called ill psychologically before they were even diagnosed, okay? I mean, this is how they were diagnosed. I heard cases of somebody, you know, going into an office and holding up a sample and the doctor on the other side of the room not making contact with the person, okay? Never looking at the sample, but diagnosing the person on the other side of the room as being delusional. without ever looking at the sample. I mean, it's like the issue was never forced out in the way it needs to be, in the most obvious way, and you start by just looking at things. And
right.
So, it was of more than passing interest that these people that presented this with direct physical and tangible evidence were marginalized in the same way that I saw those, like myself, that presented evidence of physical alteration in our environment, and they were also, let's say, attempted, as far as I'm concerned, attempts were made to marginalize them. I don't accept that.
It's a process. I describe it as the lunatics trying to persuade the adults that they're crazy.
Yeah. Remember what King Deasy's film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right?
Yeah.
What the role reversal, basically. So this is the direction the work went, and if you look at that work, it starts out with an individual, and I'm not a doctor, right? People, I make all the disclaimers in the world. I'm not a doctor. I'm an independent researcher. I do my best as a researcher, and there's no diagnosis being made ever in anything that I say, and you'll find that caveat across the board. It's not my role, but I do have a freedom. I claim the freedom to do research and to present information to the public, and I will continue to assert that role. And so it started out with an individual that did give me a physical sample, and that's what I needed. Of course, I had heard about it. I saw how people were being marginalized, but I was given a physical sample, and it was done with proper custody in terms of knowing where it came from and state of transport and all that type of thing. And I did what was the obvious to me. I looked at it. Okay? I looked at it under the microscope. I don't think, to me, that's logical. Okay, the doctor that prescribes and makes a diagnosis on the other side of the room without talking to somebody as being crazy, that's not logical to me. And the filament had unusual characteristics from the beginning, and it was clear that it was not hair or of natural origin from the body, certainly in the hair system. Now, the way the issue became especially interesting over time is that if you look at the structure and nature of that filament structure microscopically, and you make a comparison to a certain type of environmental filament that is reported in my work almost at the beginning also in the year 2000, there is a striking level of correspondence, and I do mean striking, level of correspondence between the nature and structure of these two materials. And this set the precedent, I think, in terms of the importance of the work and the potential source of the health condition. Again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not making a claim. I just present research.
Right.
But the evidence and the facts show that this correspondence does exist. And if that's the case, you know, what do I expect? You know, well, I expect the answer. I expect investigation and accounting, and I expect an answer. It's, you know, it's a style I am. If I don't get it, then what's the deal? I have to do it myself the best I can. Not the way to do it, but it's what I have to do.
So our time, we're almost at the end of the interview. So very quickly, Clifford, is it possible to say quickly what theory you have on what the filament is, or what the best papers we could find at Carnicom Institute to learn more about these filaments and what they're doing to our bodies? Because I'm assuming, you know, that people experiencing the Morgellon phenomena are just having their body reject them, whereas the rest of us are hoarding the filaments. I mean, clearly this is something happening to all of us.
Yes, and Catherine, to make sure I understand, then we only have a few minutes left on the show. Is that right? We'll close on the hour?
Yeah.
Okay, that helps then. So the claim that I would make is that there is a very important match between an environmental physical sample that dates back to really close to 2000, and also the role of the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, to refuse examination of that. It's a fascinating situation. It's all documented on the site, carnicominstitute.org. And the physical manifestation within the human body of similar structure. So this is the basic claim. And then my work proceeds to then investigate from a scientific standpoint the nature of the biology as much as possible, because the physical environment, that filament, environmental filament, had already been examined to the best of my ability at the time. As the work goes on, there is a continued parallel relationship and study between these two things. And what it, again, I'm not trying to say this is the case, but what I am saying is it presents a perfectly justifiable argument for examining the relationship between an alteration in our physical environment with the introduction of foreign materials or contaminants that are not accounted for or investigated or explained properly, and the similar and or identical manifestations of that same structure, meaning, and it's known that the environmental filament does have a biological nature to it. There is a living form that we're speaking right. of here on both accounts. And there is this relationship that is established with, I think, reasonable cause and evidence put forth, and therefore, as a society, we certainly have an obligation to seek out the specific nature of that relationship, disclose that relationship, and then act upon that disclosure.
So you're saying the filament is a living thing?
I am.
Okay. Okay, so basically what we're, you know, we have a new layer of parasites is essentially what it is.
Let me characterize that. Certainly within the body, it follows all the laws of biology that I can see at this point.
Okay.
Within the body. As an environmental filament, let's say everything says that it has the ability, it contains life forms, okay?
Right.
Whether or not it itself reproduces in that native state, that process has not been examined, but the case for the existence of biological living forms within the filament. See, it's not the housing of the filament that's of interest to me so much. It is an interest, but it's what's inside the filament, and that takes a more detailed examination. But there is biology. I guess the best answer I can give there is
right.
biology evident in both forms, both environmental as well as biological manifestation.
So I'm not subject to the same strictures you are, so I'll just say that we're paying money to the U.S. government and they're taking our taxes and spraying high-tech worms over our heads.
Yes. Yeah. I appreciate alternate characterizations of my work, Catherine.
Okay, well, there's some great materials on Magellan's. You know, get a bottle of wine and dive in because you'll need it. You know, there's some great stuff on Magellan's at your website, truly.
There is a way with our education awareness and activism and knowledge that we're not victims of these circumstances at all.
Right. And don't, please, whatever you do, if you find yourself with Magellan's, please do not lose time and money fighting with the traditional medical establishment on it. Get to some real help. I want to turn to the Carnicom Institute. What can the people listening to this do to help and support you and what you're up to over the next year or two?
Well, I suppose my role is that of a researcher, so what? Certainly one thing I desire is to make the information available. And my papers are not always fun to read, and so I wasn't in jest when I said alternate characterizations. Those that know how to translate my information into forms that the public can more readily understand, teach me. So, but obviously there is a need for for distribution and information of the system, of information, right? That's certainly a primary need. So education is a part. I do not believe that education is sufficient at all and that knowledge is sufficient. I think it's a prerequisite that we put forth our best efforts to gain knowledge and education, but we must act upon it. So if you believe the information is of value and importance, then I would call upon you to act with your skills and your talents in any and all ways imaginable and possible to put that information to advantage and application in this process, all lines of human endeavor, be it health, be it communication, be it writing, be it speaking, be it this radio show, to get the information out there and do something with it. You don't have another 20 years to hang out and hope things work out okay. You need to be in your world and make things happen. And I'm a small part of the pie that does my job, and everyone has equal responsibilities as far as I'm concerned. Certainly we take donations. That's on the site. That's not the push I make in my life. But the only way you are getting the information that we are speaking of is by having access to the means to get that information. In the world of science, it doesn't come with duct tape entirely. I've done it with duct tape a lot in my life. But the needs we're talking about are much more serious than duct tape and tubing and glass rods. And serious instrumentation is required to get the type of information that's needed. I've made some progress, but there's decades.
So I'm going to make an offer here and just tell a story. I was somebody tried to get me when I was litigating with the federal government to do a fundraiser, and I was I had one heiress look at me and say, with dripping condescension, "I would never give you money. I don't want to piss off the CIA." Anyway, so I did a fundraiser in 2010 for another organization. We raised a lot of money, and I was very excited about it. And then when we did our interview, I said, "Oh, well, great, let's do it for the Carnicom Institute." So we launched a fundraiser, and, you know, a certain amount of every subscription for a month would go to. That was the first month that we never got anyone to buy an annual subscription. We were completely stonewalled. We didn't raise a dime through that mechanism. And that's when I said, "We're going to turn around and write a check to the Carnicom Institute. You know, we'll just do," I think we did it as our Christmas thing. But what I realized, Clifford, was a lot of people are afraid. So I'm going to make an offer. Anybody listening to this who wants to make a donation to the Clifford, to the Carnicom Institute, but you don't want your name on it, just send it to Soleri, and then Soleri will donate the money to the Carnicom Institute.
I appreciate your courage, Catherine. anyone behind you, I do appreciate it. But, you know, the truth is the truth. And, you know, all these things that we think we have fear of, you know, they're just whims of our time. And they, you know, the CIA wasn't here 100 years ago. The CIA probably won't be here 100 years ago. The truth will always be there.
Right. I agree. But I also, you know, I also feel I'd love to see people who are reluctant to get, you know, here's the problem. You have so many people who have fiduciary responsibilities to their colleagues, their family, whatever. And I understand the, you know, having once tried to live in the middle of the road, Clifford, I have sympathy for them. So we're happy to launder the money to the Carnicom Institute any day of the week. So, yeah. Clifford, before we close, anything you want to add? I just want to say your site has such a wealth of resources. I really encourage everybody to get in there. And, you know, it's also very beautiful, very peaceful, despite the extraordinary nature of the topic. So anything else you want to add?
I just want to thank you for what you're doing and the courage that your listeners have to basically confront the reality of this, what we're speaking of, but then also ask them to take this and move it forward. Everyone really does have a role here. I really am just one person. I have maybe some great talents, but I'll tell you, I can rack up the things I can't do pretty easily. And I need your help is what it amounts to. And really, we all need each other's help is what it amounts to.
Yeah.
It's not even so much.
Well, I'll tell you the
part.
I will tell you, because I've gotten a chance, you know, I have lunches around the country, and if I know where you are, I will certainly get you to some of them. And our subscribers are the most amazing. You know, there are a lot of very smart, competent, capable people all around the world who are really, you know, they're moving forward and they're acting. They want to know the truth and they're prepared to act on it. So there's a mighty force out there, and I think it's rising. So
it is, and it makes it. Yeah, it does make a difference.
It does. It makes a huge difference. It makes a huge difference. Well, Clifford, it's always energizing to speak with you. I can't tell you how the esteem and respect that I hold you and your work in. And if there's anything I can do, you'll just let me know. Okay.
You already have, and you already are. So thank you very much for everything you're doing as well. I've always I appreciate it.
You have a great day, Clifford.
Yeah, thanks a whole lot, Catherine. I'll talk to you again anytime.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.